Welcome back to Canucks Talk. I'm back. Mike working now. Josh Elliott Wolf, Thomas Drantz, coming to you live from the Kintech studio. And you can text in on the 650-650 Dunbar Lumber text line. Canucks Talk is brought to you by The Hockey Shop in Langley. Shop in-store or online at thehockeyshop.com. Going to be joined in a matter of moments by Ian McIntyre covering the Canucks for Sportsnet. We'll get into everything going on with the team. Trying to get a read on what this team is, because it's been a very up and down, inconsistent stretch for the Vancouver Canucks. You've had games like they had against the Avalanche and like they had against the Panthers, where it was like, oh man, this team looks like they're figuring it out. It feels like they're back to where they should be. And then you have games like they have against the Bruins and last night, maybe to a lesser extent, another down game for them. It is Canucks Talk. Josh Elliott Wolf, Thomas Drantz. We now bring in Ian McIntyre. They call him on the closer on the postgame show, but middle relief for today. How's it going, IMac?
Yeah, I'm moving back in the bullpen as I get older. pretty soon I'll be one of those garbage relief guys, like when the starter gives up 8 runs in 2 1/3 and they need somebody just to kind of leg out 3 or 4 innings and it doesn't matter anymore.
But it's reliable. It's
yeah. Well, you know what? It still probably pays about, what, $8 million a year? So
you'll take it. It's good.
I'll take that. How does a 72-mile-an-hour fastball play these days, by the way? Is that good?
It depends where you place it.
Yeah. And if you're playing against 8-year-olds, it helps. So, you know, baseball was my second sport, and hockey wasn't the first. Soccer was the first. And then baseball. Loved baseball, but about age roughly 12, 13, pitchers started to learn stuff. And it became a lot harder to hit, but still miss it. Loved running down a fly ball, making a throw home or whatever. Great fun.
Don't miss the groin pulls, though, the first week getting back to it every year, huh?
Yeah, I guess. I'm only talking about this because anything is more fun than the first period or first 2 periods of that game last night.
Yeah, although it became awesome. The last 10 minutes were like, you know, last 10 minutes were incredible. There's the old Joe Posnanski line about baseball, which is baseball is boring until it isn't. That's the magic of it, right?
Yeah.
I love that line. Yeah. And that's the NHL regular season. The NHL regular season is boring until it isn't, and that's the magic of it. And after Dylan Gunther tied the game last night, we got 10 of the best minutes of regular season hockey the Canucks have played all year. It's just you had to sift through a lot of mid to kind of get to it. Mac, but without getting too much into the game, I'm curious to get your thoughts. 3 trades for defensemen yesterday. Yep. Will Borgen goes for a relatively hefty price tag to the New York Rangers. The Montreal Canadiens trade a 23-year-old recent first round pick with 100 games of NHL experience who happens to be 6'2" and right-handed to the Nashville Predators for Alexandre Carrier. P.O. Joseph, that's a smaller deal for future considerations.
Right.
Are you surprised at all that the Canucks weren't involved?
Well, it's always hard to answer a question like that, Thomas, when you don't know. Like, first of all, I'm sure they were involved. I'm sure they were talking when there are defensemen available.
Yes.
But we don't know what the asks are. We also don't know. Like, I strongly suspect that Carrier is a player that Montreal deliberately targeted. Like, this was a guy, for whatever reason, that they would want. So, or at least be willing to take. How about that? So, no, I wouldn't say on any one deal I'm not surprised, but we know that the Canucks have been talking to teams. And I think, you know, if anything about this management regime we've learned is they're pretty specific in the targets that they identify. They're pretty firm to a point in holding a price on what they're willing to pay, whether it be free agency or trade. But in the end, they will act aggressively when they feel they have to get the guy that they want. And I don't think the Canucks much as people think, oh, they need, you know, three or four defensemen, I'm not saying if you get three or four of the right guys, obviously they're all going to help if they're the right guys.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't see this as sort of a volume purchase by the Canucks. I think they're looking for one guy who can play on their second pair and can move the puck and has size, and anything beyond that is a bonus. But I think they really want to get that one guy. Last year it was Zadorov. This year I don't know. Well, there aren't really many Zadorov comparables. And I got to give you credit, by the way, as I digress yet again. Thomas, you said to me about 3 years ago that Zadorov was the funnest player in the NHL to watch.
Yeah, like well before the Canucks got him.
Yes, long yeah. before they got him.
Yeah.
And then he ended up in Vancouver, and then he was a riot to watch. It was great. I'm not sure I'd be wanting to pay him $5 million for a whole bunch of years into his mid-30s, but you were right about Zadorov, and I think the Canucks were right about Zadorov when they got them, and I think they want to make sure that they're right on the defenseman that they've been looking for from the start of the season. So if these guys weren't quite the guy, or let's put it another way, if they thought, well, yeah, these guys might have helped, but it's not the guy that they're targeting and the guy that they've been talking to a trading partner for, then there's no need to make a deal before Christmas. The trading deadline's a long way away.
We were discussing in the last segment, you know, to bring it back to baseball, there's the concept of the Mendoza line in baseball, right? The line yep. you have to be over to be above replacement level. And yep. while it is a higher line, I was introducing the concept of what I called the Myers line, which is, are you actually good enough that you're going to play more minutes than Tyler Myers, right? And I think, I don't know that any of the three gentlemen that got traded yesterday actually leap over. Like, Will Borgen, for me, a coin flip a coin, maybe. But you're not better than 50% chance of having him leap over the Myers line. Even Carrier, a player that I have a million hours for, really like, you know, he's not, doesn't have the size that they're going to play him with Quinn Hughes and bump Hronek to the second pair. And I don't think he has the size that this coaching staff is going to use him ahead of Myers in a matchup role ever. So, you know, he's a perfect example. Like, good player, doesn't leap over the Myers line.
I think that's an interesting way of looking at it, because again, you don't want to be spending assets to add to your sea of third pairing defensemen, right? Like, they have guys and listen, you can upgrade it everywhere, including, you know, number 5 and 6. Look at the defense that Vegas had, you know, when they won the Cup. Look at even the defense last year that Florida had. So you can improve everywhere. But again, what the Canucks have been looking for is somebody to play the second pair. So to your point, be able to play 20 minutes and maybe a little more if a Filip Hronek is injured, and maybe a little less if you're fully healthy and your third pair is holding its own. So, you know, I don't think... they need to be adding guys just to expand a pool of people who might be good enough to play for them. I think we know that they're happy with Noah Juulsen, even though he's probably not a second pair guy, although that pairing, Juulsen and Soucy, has been pretty effective in recent games. I think if you're going to spend assets, you need some kind of certainty that it's actually going to help. I mean, and again, if you look at what the Canucks did last year, they went all in on a couple of guys, but they were willing to spend the assets that they did because they knew that Zadorov would help them, and he didn't initially, but he certainly did at playoff time. And they knew that Lindholm would help them, and he didn't initially much either, but he certainly did it. But he certainly did at playoff time. Like, the playoffs made those deals make sense. They still ended up being awfully costly, but the Canucks got guys that they knew they needed. And I don't think they're going to spend assets on people who they might not need, who might not be able to help them or be any better than what they've got already.
It does feel like they are waiting for that kind of perfect piece, like top four defenseman, clearly that's going to help them. How much of their issues or inconsistencies, I guess, do you attribute to, hey, maybe you're missing a top four defenseman that would kind of fill out this roster, or are there kind of grander problems at play?
No, I think that is the grand problem. I think that is the grand problem for the Canucks. You know, there's you know, team and systems and process issues, of course, like last night, another flat start in the first period, although, I mean, they gave up some chances, but it's not like they could have been, you know, should have been down 3-0 at the intermission, but they didn't start. They didn't generate anything.
I think so they could have been, Mac. I think they could have been if Utah took their chances. Like, it was sometimes, you know, I feel like sometimes we say teams got goal lead because we're used to thinking that, but really it's that their shooters were at fault. The Canucks gave up access to prime scoring areas more frequently than they gave up actual prime scoring chances, but it's because Utah looked like they had the yips. The Utah shooters looked like they had the yips for large portions of that game. That's my take on it anyway.
Well, you may be right, but I would say based on the flow of play and where the puck was, if the Canucks came out of that period down three, I think most people would be thinking what, you know, Thatcher Demko needed to make another save.
Sure.
But I mean,
It was the third period he was really good.
Yeah. The point is they weren't very good.
No.
In the first, they got better as the game went on. But I think, you know, what we've seen, especially since Philip Ronick went out, I mean, there was a bump on that initial road trip where guys kind of stepped up. The team also had, a lot of momentum. They probably had the best mojo they've had all season on that road trip. And so they got through the first few games, and then, you know, it's been pretty obvious how much they've missed Philip Ronick since then. And again, as I said at the time, the conversation should never have been, well, what does this do for Quinn Hughes? Quinn Hughes is a world-class player. She's probably going to win the Norris again. I hope he does. He's going to be great no matter what. But it's when you do the arithmetic and you subtract Philip Ronick, and now you've got Juulsen on the second pair, and now you're sort of trying guys on the third pair. It sure would be nice if Forbert gets well and plays and just plays like he did the one game, because that'll help him a lot. But I think this has always been the issue with the team, that they need another guy who can both defend and pass the puck. Like with the forwards that they have, a lot of these games where they're struggling to get out of their end early on, or struggling to create scoring chances because the forwards never get the puck on the stick, or don't often enough get the puck on their stick. So they need another guy. They need a second pairing guy. Whether that ends up, you know, being Pettersson in Pittsburgh or whatever. They need somebody who can legitimately play second pairing minutes, handle himself in his own zone. A matchup guy would be fantastic, but has to have the ability to make a play under pressure and pass the puck to a teammate.
Mac, are we seeing, in some ways, the value of some of Vancouver's best players in their absence? You know, this team, as you noted, looked like they had mojo on that road trip where they held the fort so successfully. But when you really were watching those games, you know, they're playing coin flip hockey, just praying to get enough offense against some of the worst teams in the Eastern Conference. It really felt to me anyway, like if you ever imagined how much this Canucks team leaned on Miller to drive the bus offensively, you saw it. And for me anyway, it looked dreadful. I mean, honestly, dreadful in terms of the volume at which they were generating, as much as, you know, Pugh Suter and Jake DeBrusk's sort of shooting heaters helped cover it up. It was just like praying for offense. And now, I think likewise with Philip Hronik, his absence, I mean, you know, if you ever were talking about him as a guy benefiting from playing with Quinn Hughes, I feel like that's been, you've been disabused of that pretty quickly over the last seven games or so.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I don't know that I would go quite as extreme in my criticism of their offensive when Miller was out, because there were other factors too. But anyway, but I agree with you that when they haven't had their full lineups, they've struggled. And I think Philip Roenick, as what was he, a 23 and a half minute guy, you know, he might be, and I know the team has thought about this, the coaching staff has thought about this, he might be even more effective, dare I say, without Quinn. I'd say he might be a guy who can do more for them than what he has done as Quinn's second on that top pairing. So I'd like to retract saying be better without Quinn, because, you know, Hughes is, we're not going to see another one in Vancouver, maybe ever. It took 40 years for them to get this guy, more than 40. So he's a special player. And obviously he and Roenick are outstanding together, one of the best tandems in the league. But I do think that Roenick defers so much to Quinn when they're together, that Roenick's not trying to push the puck up ice as much as he is trying to find Quinn, get it to Quinn, and let Hughes do Hughes stuff. So I think he's I wouldn't say that Philip Roenick is an elite defenseman, but I think he's worth every penny of that contract. And that contract, by the way, is going to age well as the NHL, you know, is in this inflationary period where the cap is going to be going up fairly significant amount year over year.
Provided, of course, Mac, that the value of the Canadian dollar starts, right, stops falling, and that we avoid a trade war with the United States and Canada, and that the economy stays. Sorry,
I'm. Yes, well,
I need to stop doing I need to stop doing my cap growth is for suckers bit.
Yeah, and how about I'll just add to that as well, and that Gary Bettman doesn't lock out the players.
Ooh,
for whatever it is,
good
a fourth
point.
Time. So that might help hurt revenue as well.
Yeah. Arbitrary rollback. Let's go. Yeah. We get those every now and then.
Yeah, yeah. We need to make more. The owners aren't making enough. Poor them. How about anyways? Don't get me started. That as bad as the ownership was in Arizona, and they made out with hundreds of millions of dollars.
Oh, I know.
In the transaction at the end of the day.
And then you watch that game last night. And, you know, I know the building's not perfect. It's kind of like a Barclays Center quality NHL building, but at least it's a credible NHL building versus a college barn for NHLers. The facilities, the road facilities look fantastic with what Dan Murphy was sharing on social media. And then, you know, you've got this engaged crowd, the owners giving away 2,000 tickets, knowing the stakes of the game, and also because it's the holidays. The crowd was enormously awesome as that game went on, and especially in overtime. And you just, like, you feel so good for those players who've been through, you know, just sub NHL standard stuff undermined by this organization. Like, we're in the thick of a play. People forget they were in the thick of a playoff race until the relocation reports started dropping last year. And then they lost 17 of 18. And it was like, of course they did. Right. Like, man, what a relief it must be for the players on that team to actually have a shot to compete without the organization in your way this season.
Yeah. Well, they were my surprise pick. And they've had a solid season. I thought they might be even a little better, but I guess it's early yet.
Oh, I think they're for real. I think they're making the playoffs. I'm pretty close to putting my stamp on it. I thought they were significantly better than Vancouver 5-on-5 last night, including winning the minutes in which the Canucks had both Hughes and Miller on the ice together. And I think I've said that like six times all season, right? Like, that's an impressive show.
Yeah, that doesn't happen very often. Hughes or anybody.
Nope.
Just Hughes. It doesn't happen very often. The other team has more scoring chances.
Yes.
So, yeah, I think they have wonderful players. I'm not the tear-down, rebuild kind of guy, because I just, like a lot of people, I'd like to see where the the proof is. And I don't want to get you started, Thomas. I'm not trying to provoke you.
No, but you're that, right. You're right. Pittsburgh and Chicago haven't won six cups in the last 15 years. There's no proof whatsoever. Don't worry. Yeah. L.A. also won
all
two
gotta
in
do,
there.
All you got to do is get the first overall pick and get generational players for your first overall pick. So any other rebuild, like
Patrick Kane, generational? Come on.
Well, he's one of the best 10 players of his era.
Yeah.
Was he not?
I mean,
I'm not saying generational.
He was one of the 10 best clutch scorers for sure.
Yeah.
But yeah. I mean, would you take him over Stamkos and Tavares in terms of his actual quality? Or was it that he was, you know, put in more positions to make a difference with his skill set? I don't know. I think it's I don't know that, like, was he a better first overall than McKinnon? Oh yeah, the Avs. I forgot the Avs. That's another good example. Another cup winner. Oh, Florida.
I forgot about Florida. The Avs did not do a teardown rebuild, and Florida, I have to go back and look. The Avs did not do a teardown rebuild. They traded Duchesne because Duchesne wanted out. You know, I knew this would happen. I knew that you would get insecure.
I'm not insecure. I'm just
have to be the smartest guy in the room
Hey, I'm not trying to be the smartest guy in the room. That's an accident of fate. But I don't know. I seem to remember them drafting Duchesne third and then Landeskog second and then McKinnon first over a 4-year span. And I don't know if you're in the top three for 3 or 4 years, that sounds like a territory to me.
Were they dumping all their best players to try and be there? Anyways, I'm going to say that I think that there's some really good players on Arizona and probably a better group that gets less radar than some of the young players on other teams. But I think they've got some really good players. And I also think some of the players that they have kept, and Krause would be one, even though Krause has maybe never been the player that he was projected to be, but he's a pretty good guy to have in the middle of your lineup. I think they've got a few of those guys too. And now that they have ownership that actually wants to do well and is enabling the GM, who's enabling the coach, to try to win games, I hope they win a pile of them, because I think that's going to be a good market for the NHL. I think that's a good template to go to a place that loves sports, is starved for major league sports other than their basketball team, and the hockey team will be able to have a pretty lofty perch in that community, especially if they have some success, which I think they're going to have.
Hey, Ian, really appreciate you taking the time. Thank you for this.
Oh, I love coming on and arguing with
it's the best. Thanks, Ian.
Yeah.
Appreciate it, buddy.
See you guys.
Ian McIntyre, brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Be a champion on the worksite. Find them together online at dleamc.com. I do love that he was like, okay, I don't want to get Drant started. And then Thomas immediately was like, let me get started. It was fun.
It's like there's no evidence that it works, except nearly every cup winner of the last 15 years, with the exception of...
It is...
Who's your exception?
I think
your exceptions
are St. Louis.
No, because St. Louis had a massive bottom out period that brought in all the best players on that team. Yeah, yeah. They had a run of four top five picks across 5 years, but one of them they traded out and ended up drafting like Perron. They traded the Logan Couture pick and got Perron. But no, I mean that the core of that team, Schmaltz was Schmaltz, Perron, and Cole.
I mean, Ryan O'Reilly was on that team too, and he was brought in via trade.
Sure, no, but I mean, I'm just saying the 07-08, like from, so 2006, they have two first round picks because they're trading down stuff, including the 101 Eric Johnson. Mm-hmm. Didn't end up mattering to their cup chances. Next year, they have three first round picks, 2 seconds, right? The next year, they get Pietrangelo, fourth overall, and then Jaden Schwartz at 14 and Vladimir Tarasenko at 16. That's the year they trade out of the Logan Couture spot in the top 10. So they've got a run of top 10 picks in 4 or 5 years with multiple draft picks, and that's like the core of that team. Tarasenko, Pietrangelo, Schwartz, you can that core was constructed during a tear it down rebuild. The exception truly, and even Tampa, Stamkos and Hedman, the exception is truly the Boston Bruins.
Yeah. Do you throw Vegas in there too? We could talk about this.
Oh
later.
Yeah, Vegas belongs in the exceptions tier as well.
Anyway, music is playing. This is Canucks Talk. On the other side, we'll get into a lot more. Josh Elliott, Wolf, Thomas Strands here on Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk. Josh Elliott Wolf, Thomas Strantz here with you, coming to you live from the Kintech studio. Kintech, Canada's favorite orthotics provider, powered by thousands of five-star Google reviews. Sore feet? What are you waiting for? And you can text in 650-650, the Dunbar Lumber text line, Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and reno warriors for over 50 years. Visit them at one of their three locations to serve you, or online at DunbarLumber.com. And Canucks Talk is brought to you by the Hockey Shop in Langley. It's a great day for hockey. The Vancouver Canucks taking on the Vegas Golden Knights tonight. Second half of a back-to-back. One hit some of your texts. And also, we were talking a little bit earlier about the Utah Hockey Clubbers, or as you call them, their Utah Hockey Club. What's your confidence level in this team this year? Because ahead of the season, I've kind of been like high on the Coyotes eventually being good for a while. They moved to Utah. I was like, okay, this is the year.
Anaheim?
Yeah, exactly.
I'm a Ducks slappy. The Ducks, I've been waiting for the Ducks to turn it around forever. They won last night. Winnipeg looked dog tired, though.
Yeah, good for Anaheim. This is the start. But for Utah, I picked them to make the playoffs this year. Dom's model has them at 42%, I believe. If you're a Canucks fan, you might not want them to make the playoffs because it might come down to you or them, depending on...
Wow.
I mean...
You or Colorado or them. Like, winning against Colorado was so meaningful. If you'd lost to Colorado and then lost in overtime to the Utah Hockey Club...
Yeah.
I think we'd be... having a much more panicked conversation. It's so funny, though. The Canucks are in such a funny spot where, I mean, they're 5 points back of Vegas.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And yet, they're 3 points up on Utah, who are in eighth, and two up on Calgary.
Yeah.
Who with the game in hand. And that's the playoff bar.
Mm-hmm.
Right, like Colorado and Calgary, that's the playoff bar. So there's, it's like they're in a position designed to maximize stress.
Yeah. But do you think Utah is a legitimate playoff threat?
I absolutely do. I mean, this Utah team is really impressive, and I thought it was so. Last night during the first period, it looked a lot like I kind of expected it to for a couple of reasons. One, this Canucks team's alternating bad games and quality games, so it was time for a bad game anyway.
It's a really fun cycle.
Yeah, it's not fun at all. Good joke, though. Seriously, it's tough. Secondly, Utah hadn't played since Saturday. Like, the Canucks had literally played... This was their third game since Utah had last finished theirs.
Mm-hmm.
So... they were far more rested, and I expected with young legs, home ice, no travel, more that level of a rest advantage. You thought most likely Utah is going to have legs that the Canucks don't in this one. Lastly, and here's the terrifying truth: Utah is a better hockey team 5-on-5
than the Canucks,
and not by a slim margin. Like, this isn't debatable. Utah has outscored their opposition 63-51 at 5-on-5 over the course of this season in their 31 games. Vancouver 64-59. And you know, Vancouver's shot 10% to do it. Utah's shot 9.2%. Now, Vancouver maybe has slightly better finishing talent, but it's not like Gunther and Keller and Cooley aren't high-skilled players who can finish their chances too, right? Mm-hmm. In terms of shot attempt differential, okay, the following teams control play better than Utah does in the entire NHL. The Carolina Hurricanes, duh. The Florida Panthers, also duh. And the Edmonton Oilers.
Yeah.
That's it. That's it.
And it's not even like this isn't to disparage the Canucks. Like Utah is just, they're good.
Utah might be, no, 5-on-5, they're five elite. On five.
Yeah.
This is an elite team through the first 31 games of the season. And we're now at the point 30 games in where the sample is meaningful enough for us to say this is a team that's trending toward being elite 5-on-5. And so, you know, there's some holes there. Their penalty kill is not good enough, mm-hmm. right? Their goaltending has been good, not great, right? There's some softness, I think, in terms of their, well, their overall 5-on-5 profile is fantastic. There's, you know, some issues in terms of, like, they surrender slot shots at one of the 10 highest rates in the league, right? So there's some gaps in their quality as a team. But you can see it. Like, you can see their fastball. You can see the problem-solving in all three zones. You can see the speed. You can see the way that they generate off the rush. Like, this is a very, very dangerous team at 5-on-5, trending toward being dangerous, not just as like a playoff aspirant, but like as a real dark horse when they get there, if they get there. So, you know, it just kind of is what it is. Now, for all that I thought Utah was a real threat, in the early part of the game, I thought there was some seriously wasteful moments from some of Utah's best players, and especially Yusuf Alamaki as shooters. I thought they were getting into prime scoring areas at will, but weren't necessarily generating prime scoring chances at will.
They were making a lot of extra passes.
A lot of extra passes, a lot of indecision, hesitation in terms of their attacking verve, as it were. And I thought that held them back in the first. And I was watching it just thinking, I've seen this game before. I've seen this game a million times. Utah controls play. Canucks withstand the body blows. Canucks get one off a bounce. They ended up getting a really nice one, a deflection goal that I wouldn't call a bounce, or not a ricochet goal that I wouldn't call a bounce. It was a tremendous Danton Heinen shot,
yeah,
and an intentional shot in search of a rebound. So, you know, I'm not calling that a lucky one. Then they get the Dakota Joshua goal against the grain. And we know how good this Canucks team usually is at removing all oxygen from the third period against a trailing team. And, you know, I was like, okay, well, this is one of those lessons that a team that might not be ready for prime time is going to learn. And then Utah just ventilated the Canucks in the third period. And that's I think, a really important point here. I saw Canucks fans complaining about the Myers cross-check penalty and whatever. Canucks, not just Canucks fans. Fans are going to complain about officiating. And cross-checking penalties are so arbitrarily assessed that, like, yeah, it was clearly a cross-check.
Yeah, I thought
and then,
it was.
And then fans can say, well, that happens 20 times a game. And it's like, yeah, it's right. You're right. But it gets called twice. Like, it's not yeah. that it never gets called. And it's just that it doesn't always get called.
And often refs will go to players and be like, hey, like, you got to, next time you do that, I have to call you. And
right.
So there are in-game situations like that too, that play into it that fans aren't necessarily privy to, but I do agree that it's always easy for fans and media at times to be like, well, if that's being called, why wasn't this one called? Or if this isn't being called, why was this one called? And it's just so, especially with cross-checking, like you said, it is so arbitrary that it's so hard to, like, hang a loss on that and be like, oh, this is the reason the Canucks lost the game, because it did feel like, to your point, like Utah turned it on in the final 10 minutes.
Well, and I think they turned it on before that. I thought at no point in the third period did the Canucks look like they had this salted away. I know Clearsight Analytics had 7 high danger scoring chances for the Utah Hockey Club, for the Klubers.
The Klubers.
And the Klubers over the course of the game. And that was, that's significantly more than the Canucks usually surrender over the course of an entire game. And they battled back. And then even when the game, like, the Canucks had some chances late too, that both teams were pressing, I thought Utah had the balance of chances. I honestly thought it looked like the Canucks were outmatched for large segments of the second half of that game. That's impressive. To me, that's impressive because it's not just young team needs to learn a lesson against cagier veteran, more battle-tested side. It was young team learned that lesson and processed it and then came out and flattened and stole a win from cagey veteran, more battle-tested side. That, to me, is when you're really cooking. Like, now we got a stew going, Josh.
Yeah, for the Utah Hockey Clerbers. one thing I will say about them before we move on, the one thought I've had is I look at their team and it does feel like they're that one big piece away from being taken seriously. And I do wonder if next time there's an Eichel type available, or, you know, just like a premier star talent available in the NHL for whatever reason, I wonder if Utah is going to be the team going hard after that player. And especially with Ryan Smith as the owner, I'm sure he wants to make a splash. It feels like that would be such a layup for them, for them to go hard after someone that could potentially be available. Who knows who that player is? Maybe it's Elias Pettersson. Let's get crazy. Probably not. But someone like that, where it's just a clear, undeniable top-end talent, I wouldn't be surprised if Utah is the team going hard after that player.
Well, Ryan Smith is going to be aggressive. No question. Ryan Smith, the Utah owner, he's going to be aggressive, super involved, super excited. He should be. I mean, what a cool scene that was last night. And what a fun end to the hockey game. Like, that's the sort of game where if you've never been to an NHL game and you're from Utah and your team pulls a comeback like that, you know, you might be a fan for life.
Yeah, makes you a fan. That's the kind of game that makes the Utahns a fan of the club. Moving on. So we talked a bit about the Alex Carrier trade yesterday to the Montreal Canadiens for Justin Barron. The Nashville Predators this whole season have been a very interesting team to keep an eye on because they have obviously made all those moves in the summer, have not worked out, and Barry Trotz seems a little trigger happy right now, potentially. Does it feel like, and it kind of seems like the consensus online right now is that the Predators and Barry Trotz might be a mark. Like, hey, this is a team we can take advantage of right now and try to pry away some of their decent players. And obviously Trotz came out and said, hey, I'm willing to trade anybody except like six of the main guys. So it didn't really make a difference. But could Nashville be a team that the Canucks look at potentially as trying to find some interesting options on their roster? Is there anyone that sticks out to you from Nashville that if Barry Trotz is looking to make some moves and he feels like he could be close to doing something big, is there anyone on Nashville that sticks out to you, Drance?
No. No, not really. Like, and it's less about the Canucks, more about like a team like Utah or a team like the Kings, like a team that you feel like is one star short. You know, I don't think we feel like the Canucks are one star short. I think they could use another star forward, to be totally honest with you. Especially, yeah. Like,
if you aren't getting the level of production that you're used to, especially from your three main guys and Brock Besser, JT Miller, and Elias Pettersson.
Well, but also throw in Nils Höglander, who was a 24-goal scorer last season and hasn't scored since November 2nd, right? I mean, JT Miller hasn't beaten a goalie for a goal. And granted, he missed 10 games over the course of the segment since October 25th, right? Two empty net goals in his last 13 games.
That's nuts.
Huh?
That's nuts. That's a long time.
And, you know, and you sort of go down the line, like, it's not just that they're not scoring goals or producing, they're not controlling play. So, you know, I do think the Canucks maybe I shouldn't discount the Canucks as a team that could use another star forward, especially given, you know, the Rutherford track record that we've talked about so often, which is, you know, when you think your team is close and you want to put them over the top, right? Go land established veteran scorer. But I mean, the guy everyone should want out of Nashville is Philip Forsberg. I don't think this is controversial. Yeah. You got to hope that things go sideways enough for the Predators that they consider that. And then you got to hope that it's not Utah or LA. Like, LA with Philip Forsberg to me is then that team, like, Doesn't it feel like, as well as LA has played, and they might be the second best 5-on-5 team in hockey this season, It's like their absolute ceiling is going and winning two games against Edmonton in the playoffs.
Yeah, it's just like there's no way they beat Edmonton.
Right.
I don't care how good they do during the regular season, unless they make a big move like Philip Forsberg. It's just like, well, it was fun, guys. Good job.
Well, and does it feel to you like the Canucks' absolute ceiling might be winning three against Edmonton?
Yeah. Especially right now. Right now, it like, and I fully admit,
oh,
I'm
right
gonna,
now, right now, right now, like, they're not. Right now, they're not winning three.
Right now, they're
I'm
getting
saying.
Swept.
So, well, I mean,
I'm fully down.
Yikes!
No, they're going to win tonight, and then it'll be fine.
But I feel like if LA could land a Philip Forsberg, we'd be having a different conversation. So, I mean, that to me is the thing. Is like Nashville's so fascinating because we'll see how deep this goes, how poorly they play, how lengthy this sort of run of impurity continues, and if it continues deeply enough that they have to consider something truly tectonic, if they're one of those teams that makes a Stanley Cup winner, right? Because that's, I often think about it in terms of that, right? Like the Florida Panthers, when they first hired Dale Tallon,
yeah,
were a team that made two Stanley Cup finalists, right? They traded, well, I guess not really in the Canucks case, but they traded Ballard to Vancouver. The Canucks ended up in the Stanley Cup final that year. And Nathan Horton and Dennis Seidenberg and Gregory Campbell, you know, the talisman, to the Boston Bruins. Like, both Stanley Cup finalists had made a major, major deal with them to get there. You know, Buffalo has made like a bunch of cup winners over the last few years. Jack Eichel and Sam Reinhart and on and on.
And they're going to do it again this year.
And they might do it again this year. So, you know, I sometimes look at, like, you look at the sickest teams, the teams that are in the, that are the most down bad. And it's like, they might not win a cup, but they could make a cup winner. And Nashville to me is just like one of those teams. And yet when you look it over, look up and down their roster, like, who really qualifies as a guy who can help put a team over the top, aside from a Josi, who they're not ever trading, and Philip Forsberg, they're probably not, also not ever trading. But if it ever happened, right, that's the guy that all these teams should be lining up to try and snag.
I would be interested in a Tommy Novak.
I guess Tockett would not play him.
No?
No.
That's kind of the frustrating part.
Brock Besser's USHL line mate. They were sick together for, I guess, was the Waterloo Blackhawks.
Yeah.
Anyway, I mean, I've got time for Tommy Novak, but I don't see that being a fit.
It is the frustrating part about this is
maybe Evangelista. Evangelista would be the other guy who I would be curious to see if another team could steal.
And those are kind of like they're going to have an impact type of players, but they're not going to be put you over the top players, like you mentioned with Philip Forsberg or someone more notable like that. And it doesn't feel like the Canucks are operating in that territory, especially when it comes to a forward. Obviously, on defense, if someone of that caliber becomes available, that seems like something the Canucks, but also a lot of teams, are going to be keeping a closer eye on. 650-650 Dunbar Lumber text line. Let's hit some of these texts before we go to break. This one from Avery in Vancouver early in the show asks, the team already chose JT Miller over Bo Horvat 2 years ago. Are we now facing another decision where the team has to choose between JT Miller and Elias Pettersson? Is this relationship fixable? That's from Avery in Vancouver.
I don't know. I've never talked to either of them about it, so I'm not going to opine. All I know is that I don't think that this is, a fabricated, out-of-thin-air talking point. And so, you know, I do think there's work to be done figuring out how this team can compete for one another and how some of their best players and most important players can coexist. And, you know, I do get the sense that that's an ongoing process, and we'll see where it goes.
The other thing about that, too, is just that, even putting any issues aside, they both need to be better. The top six as a whole needs to be better. Like, they have not scored nearly enough in the last few games.
I like this question. Are the Canucks a good team that has played bad games or a bad team that has played good games? Are they a good bad team or are they a bad good team?
I think they're a bad good team.
Yeah, I think that's right. They're they know how to win games. Like, they're really good at managing games and, like, grinding out games, and they usually outperform in terms of the scoreboard their actual form. You know, like, when the Canucks come out and play a really good game, how many times have we seen the Canucks come out and play a game that they deserved to win and didn't in the last year and a half?
Rarely.
I can't even think of one.
Yeah.
But I can think of a lot of times where they're getting away with it.
Yeah. I don't know. It's frustrating to an extent, but also it's like, well, they keep getting away with it, so I guess it's fine.
See, the problem is, though, is if you keep getting away with it, it sometimes gives you license to not make the necessary changes. Like, here's the truth. Over the last 6 weeks, and granted there's a lot of injury noise in this, the Canucks have played concerning hockey, and if they continue to play at that level 5-on-5, they're going to drop more games than they win. Like, period. Now, Demko being back and looking solid, in my opinion anyway, I know the goals against weren't, like, all three goals against were things you could backseat drive, but I think on balance, he was a major reason why they secured a point last night.
There was that diving save late.
Oh, that was like on Carcone. That was incredible.
Mm-hmm.
So, Michael Carcone, another one of the Eddie Lack, Chris Tanev, Troy Stetcher tree of quality Canucks undrafted free agents. So organization's done pretty decently, by the way.
They just fine dudes.
Yeah. Anyway, So what were we talking about? I've completely spaced.
We were talking about what were we talking about? Oh man, we can't have all just lost it right
now. I'm just gonna let you guys stew in this for a minute.
Okay. Anyway, point being, I don't remember what we were talking about, but the
point being nothing.
No, good bad team versus bad good team. Yeah, I think they're at the moment a good bad team, but they should be just a good team.
Yes.
And I think they have that in them. At some point, though, we need to see it. At some point, we need to see it, and we need to see it be sustained before we can say it unequivocally.
Yeah, for sure. 650-650. Keep the text coming in. We'll hit more on the other side. If you got any questions, anything you want to talk about, feel free to text it in. 650-650. It is Canucks Talk. Josh Elliott Wolf, Thomas Drantz. Back on the other side, it is Sportsnet 650.
Do you know them? No. But in DeClerb, we all fam. What? In DeClerb, we all fam. I don't... In the club, we are all family.
Do you want me to think that you're wild?
Welcome back to Canucks Talk. Josh Elliott Wolf, Thomas Drantz here with you, coming to you live from the Kintec studio. And you can text in 650-650, the Dunbar Lumber text line. Canucks Talk is brought to you by The Hockey Shop in Langley. Shop in-store or online at thehockeyshop.com. Drantz and I are we're here today and tomorrow in the normal Canucks Talk slot. And then Monday, Tuesday, we are the morning show. Are you ready for that? I'm not sure if I'm ready for morning Drantz personally.
Oh yeah, no, I'm really high energy in the morning, just like I am all the time. What's more interesting to me is going to be covering the game that night.
On the 23rd against San Jose, it's a 7:30 puck drop too.
7:30 puck drop. So I'm going to need a nap.
It's going to be so rough.
Yeah.
Against San Jose, too. What is happening? But Macklin Celebrini playing his first game.
Oh, heck yeah. So much
Vancouver.
Fun.
He has been so good this year.
He's just a blast to watch play. Very excited for
him. If you were to, and maybe you guys talked about this, but if you were to have to put one of Connor Bedard or Macklin Celebrini on the Four Nations team, who would it be?
Well, on form, you'd have to pick Celebrini.
Right.
But I would have liked to see Canada bring both, because I think by 2024, both will be on the team. So I thought it would have been cool to blood them both now, you know?
I do agree. That's the reason I would have at least taken Bedard, because it does feel like next year-ish in Italy, he's going to be on the team. It would be very surprising if he wasn't on the team, if he stalled out this much. But Celebrini has just made much more of an impact than I expected him to this early in his career, especially on a what is supposed to be bad San Jose Sharks team. 650-650, Dunbar Lumber text line. We asked for some questions or comments before the break. This one, unsigned. Does this team not play fast, or are they slow, or is it both?
I think they play faster than their speed when they're on their game, like against Florida and Colorado. I think they can get on top of teams that are faster than them. So I think they want to play fast. I do not think they have enough speed. I do think that they have trouble with faster teams. I think that's an issue that dates back several years. I think it's been more pronounced this season, in part because they're not playing fast. So it's chicken and egg. I think they are. I don't think they're a slow team, though. I just think they're sort of like an average speed team where faster teams can bog them down. But I think they can also stay on top of faster teams when they're playing fast, which they haven't been doing consistently enough. So they want to play fast. They are like medium fast. And when they don't play fast, that really shows.
Because last year, like just looking back to last year, and look, a lot of things were going their way, so maybe it clouds the judgment of everything. But it did feel like they were an objectively slower team when you look at the players on the roster, and especially the guys they brought in over the summer. They were brought in with the idea of making the team faster and playing better off the rush.
And I think they did.
Mm-hmm.
I honestly, shooting 15% is a hell of a drug.
Yeah.
Right? A lot of what we thought we saw in the first half from this team was a mirage. But what wasn't a mirage was the way that this team improved over the course of the season and began to control play and become an elite defensive team. Like, that was real. And that gave them a real shot entering the season. The issue that we're seeing is, and last night was a really good example, they were not good defensively. Like, they were far too permissive. Utah generated far too much, both in terms of accessing high-quality areas of the ice, dangerous areas of the ice in the first period, and then actually converting on those sort of opportunities into real scoring chances in the third. It just wasn't a clean defensive effort from the team, and it was an effort where I don't think they were on top of the Utah Hockey Club for even a second. And so that makes them look slow, and that's partly why it was such a flat performance, you know, even though they battled really hard in the last 10 minutes.
One thing that's I guess been a theme of the season that a lot of people are pointing out, and I saw a lot last night, has been the trouble in the neutral zone for the Vancouver Canucks. And it's felt like they're simultaneously giving up the neutral zone a little bit too easily, especially defensively. Meanwhile, when they're on offense, it feels like teams, when they clog the neutral zone against the Canucks, they struggle to have an answer. And I do wonder if that plays into the, hey, like when you're watching this team, they feel slow. And it kind of feels like when, especially on offense, is when you notice it, it doesn't feel like they're entering the zone with any speed. And I think a lot of that is because they're getting kind of clogged up in the neutral zone. And I don't know how to solve that issue. I don't know if that's a personnel issue or if they have to approach things differently offensively and when it comes to zone entries. But I think that might also lead to a lot of these dump and chase sequences that fans get frustrated with. Well, it's because they kind of have no other option at times. And I'm not saying that's always the case, but a lot of the times it does feel like they're kind of boxed into a corner almost, and the only play is to dump it in and hope you can do something, because they're not entering the neutral zone or the offensive zone with enough speed to be able to carry it in effectively. Would you agree?
I would. I think I don't know that the Canucks lost the game in the neutral zone last night, though.
I don't think like last night necessarily was the best example, but that's just been a recurring theme, I guess, for the team.
Yeah, and they tried to install more of that like anchoring play breakout that teams are doing with the sort of player that comes across the blue line and hits, you know, a forward attacking downhill with speed. I do think that the injuries submarined the aggression that this team was trying to install into their game in the first part of the year, right? Through the first 16 games, I was looking at this team as having shown meaningful progress as an attacking group. And then JT Miller's absence occurs. You know, they play without Brock Besser for a spell. Then they lose Filip Hronek. And all of a sudden, you've got a team that is generating very, very little. Like, there is very little happening for the Canucks when they're on the ice, you know, dating back a fairly lengthy segment of time now, right? You sort of can go back to mid-November, right? And you will see a team that's generating scoring chances, shots, shot attempts at one of the lowest rates in the league, 5-on-5. And it's really hard to live like that. I think as the game went on last night, you saw some of the... One thing that I notice about this Canucks team, right, is sometimes it feels like they're arsonists. Like, they can't really build their own attacks, right? The goals that you see that are the result of, like, seven players touch the puck and it's a team-level move, right, and are few and far between, right? Mm-hmm. You see a lot more Canucks force a quick turnover, get a guy in space, shot goal, or shot rebound goal, or a spectacular pass goal. And it's more that, like, quick strike form of offense.
Yeah.
And that's great. Like, I love that. You need that in hockey. One great thing about a game like hockey is you're always both defending and attacking, whether you have the puck or not. And I think the Canucks are great at attacking without the puck. And I think they're limited when they're attacking with the puck. And last night was a game where it felt like they were completely reliant on Utah mistakes to feed their ability to generate scoring chances. And that's okay, because teams make mistakes. Like, it's a game of mistakes, and that's a relatively reliable source of offense, but it's not a perfect source of offense. And it's a negative source of offense. It's a source of offense that you don't directly control. You're relying on your opponent to mess it up. And I do think ultimately, if you're going to win against the best teams in the league at the pointy end of the season, you need to be able to build a lot better than this Canucks team has. Now, again, I thought this team had made some progress, but, like, let me give you this example. Last 14 games, okay? The Canucks are generating 22 shots per hour, 5-on-5, 22 shots on goal. Only one other team in the league is under 23, and that's the New York Islanders.
Mm-hmm.
Yikes. Right?
Yeah.
The following teams over that stretch are under 25. The Blues, the Canadians, the Red Wings, the Blackhawks, the Islanders, the Canucks. And the Canucks are last with a bullet, like, by a fair margin.
That's not great company.
No, that's not where you want to be. Shot attempts. The Canucks are the only team in the league over the last 14 games under 48 shot attempts per hour.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Expected goals, only them and the Chicago Blackhawks under 2 per hour. Okay? Yeah. So this team is very pop gun. Now, I think this is one of those things, too, where it's been hard to see, in part because the Canucks are fifth in 5-on-5 shooting percentage over that time frame. Like, Jake DeBrusk finding timely goals by putting them home, but putting home rebounds and loose change in the slot has single-handedly masked just how, like, completely lacking in any consistent threat or dynamism this team is as an attacking group of 5-on-5 right now. And, you know, it's inexplicable solely due to the absence of Miller and Hronek, or Miller and then Hronek. Like, I think there's more going on. I think this team has had to recalibrate their method, their model, their approach to generating offense. I think they've decided that they're going to try and win coin flip games for the interim. And I think they're comfortable winning those games. And honestly, they're pretty good at it.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a firm and low ceiling, like a hobbit hole ceiling, on what that leaves as a hockey team. And if this persists, not just when Hronek returns, but even for another 15 games, it's going to be very, very difficult. This team is going to have very little margin for error to do as well as they have over the course of this period of time. And you know, 607 point percentage across these games while generating literally nothing offensively, like league worst offense. And they've still managed to win 7 of 14 while picking up points in 10 of 14. you know, the Ottawa Senators have won 4 in a row, have the same point percentage over the same stretch of games. They have a better point percentage than teams like Florida and Colorado and Carolina and Winnipeg over that stretch. So they're not losing ground playing this way. So how do you abandon what's worked for you during some absences and inconsistency, right? You don't. Like, you just don't.
I do think the frustration, though, is that it feels like they could be doing both. You know, like you can keep this level of defensive structure. Maybe you do have to sacrifice a little bit, but there should be a way to create more offense here. Like, you look at the offensive pieces on this team, and it just feels undeniable that, like, they should be at least an average team when it comes to creating offense, right? Like, Elias Pettersson, JT Miller, Quinn Hughes, even with Philip Peronic out, they should be at least top 20 if we want to be generous in terms of creating offense. And to be at the bottom or near the bottom of the league when it comes to expected goals and creating offense, it's just frustrating, I think, because, again, you look at these pieces and it just feels like there should be more there. But it almost feels like they found this comfortable spot again where it's like, well, you know what? Things are breaking our way and we're playing well defensively. So let's just keep doing this and not try to rock the boat.
Well, Miller Time texts in, or the Canucks, the high school student that crams the night before a test, gets a C+, and doesn't learn the lesson for the next test.
It feels right.
I hope not. I mean, the thing is that they're aware organizationally that they're not spending enough time in the offensive end. Like, they know that this isn't going to prove sustainable as the sample expands. Like, mm-hmm. They know that. You know, it's not like Rick Tocchet and the Canucks management went into this offseason and thought to themselves, what we need to do is double down on what worked for us last year. They tried to evolve. They tried to bring in different pieces with a higher offensive ceiling. They signed Daniel Sprong, even though they abandoned the experiment relatively quickly. Heinen, Sherwood, DeBrusque. They reallocated money from the back end, obviously an issue for the club, and put it on the wings. They tried to add speed. They tried to add attacking verve. They tried to add a more reliable, more consistent one-shot scoring threat up front. Like, these are not the actions of a team that's deluded about where they are, mm-hmm. right? And right now, they're not deluded about how they're playing. And so that, to me anyway, is a good sign, a good process indicator that this team knows where their weaknesses are, has a realistic self-assessment of what they need to do to get better. But, you know, I do think that they've at least compromised somewhat on that stylistically, because there's the extent to which their offense has fallen off in the second half of a 31 game season, right? Like 15 games of absolute dreck offensively, 16 games where it looked like they were showing signs of progress. I don't think it's a coincidence. I think it's clear that this team is modified in midstream the way that they're playing to make games into sort of lower event contests, trust their shooters to be more efficient than their opposition shooters, and trust their sort of tactical noose as a group to kind of carry them through this hold the fort stretch, which we're still in because of the Hronik injury. It's not a lot of fun to watch, and I do think it's making it really difficult for us to see what this team is clearly, because playing like this, they're not a contender, period. You are not a contender if you're generating shots and scoring chances and offense at this rate. You're not. You know what you're going to bump into? You're going to bump into a good team that doesn't make the mistakes that feed your offense, right? And you're going to get through two of your most crucial games of the season generating something like 32 total shots and scoring 3 total goals across 2 games, which, by the way, is what happened to this team last year. And they didn't have 15 game stretches this feckless offensively last year. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this is an area that needs improvement. And as much as we think the back end is a part of it, right, that some puck moving would certainly help, and I think that's true, I also think it comes down to individual execution. And I do suspect that there's something there in terms of this team wanting, at the moment anyway, to play lower event hockey as they sort of leg through some key injuries.
650, keep the text coming in. Tonight, the Vancouver Canucks taking on the Vegas Golden Knights. So let's look ahead to that. No morning skate today for the team, obviously playing back-to-backs, though we would expect Kevin Lankinen to get the start against Vegas, and we will see about Derek Forbert still battling the flu, both him and Lankinen, though we saw Lankinen back up last night, obviously, for the Canucks. So we'll see how that develops. No Ivan Barbashev or Nicholas Waugh for Vegas tonight. So the Canucks getting a break there. What do you expect tonight?
Yeah, no Ivan Barbashev is, you know, unfortunate from an aesthetic perspective. Like, we you know, it's just fun to watch Ivan Barbashev be a giant human being that scores hilarious goals.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a nice break for the Canucks. I think Ivan Barbashev is pretty crucial to what this team does well. Look, Jack Eichel, Mark Stone, Pavel Dorofeev, that line is going to be key tonight. We've seen Eichel dissect the Canucks with a disturbing level of calm, like I'd say ease. Jack Eichel beats you, and he beats you with ease sometimes, and it's disturbing to watch when he's on his game and gets that done. Canucks need to make it a tough night for him. Like, first things first, you don't want Jack Eichel to look that comfortable. Whether he beats you or not, you don't want him to look comfortable doing it.
Make it hard.
At least make it a little hard. So that's number one thing I'm looking for. The way that this team is playing, right, is so interesting, because you've got, they are straight up just loaded down the middle, and that's the strength of their team, and they're leaning into it. So Eichel, Carlson, Hurdle, all on different lines. Now, if the game script goes a certain way, you could see Hurdle elevate. But, you know, Howden, Carlson, Olofsson's going to be a second line. I mean, Howden's played really good, and he's a big physical body. Carlson, obviously, a stud defensively. Man, you look at their forwards, though, and you just think, how can those guys hang with the Canucks, like, given their quality on the wings, given some of the two-way gaps in guys like Holtz and Olofsson's game?
Mm-hmm.
But the reason they're most likely to is they've got these drivers. They've got Hurdle, Carlson, Eichel on different lines, and even absent huge key difference makers like Barbashev and Waugh, and what that does to the rest of the lineup, you know, they should have enough to make it a difficult night for the Canucks. And then on defense, you know, obviously we know what they can do. So, I mean, look, it's the second leg of a back-to-back. You're on the road. Hostile environment against a really good team that, by the way, has punched well above their... They've got their own five-on-five deficiencies themselves. Like, they are not controlling play like an elite team, even though they're getting elite results. In some ways, this is a mirror image fight. It's just a mirror image fight in which the structure of both teams is reversed. The Canucks are built outside in. The Vegas is built inside out. What you don't want is to fall behind early. What you need to avoid is the Pittsburgh game script, right? Where the Canucks play a road back to back and fall behind early, and then you're chasing and you're tired and you're playing Quinn Hughes 28 minutes a night, and it's the second leg of a back to back, and the diminishing returns are incur as the game goes along, and you end up with key players tired in situations that they're not usually, like a defender, Filip Hronek, for example, you know, but below the goal line in the offensive zone, takes a hit, gets hurt, right? Like, that's, manage the game here. You got to keep it close. If you're going to win, you got to lead early. You got to get up early, and then you got to use your energy to defend and play smart, as opposed to using your energy to chase the game. It's too hard in this league, and it's too hard against this Vegas team to be chasing the game. So that's the number one thing I want to see from the Canucks tonight. That's the number one thing I want to see from the Canucks every time they play a back-to-back set. In the second leg, spend that energy. Don't waste it. Don't hold anything in reserve. Go out and play your 10 best minutes in the first 10 minutes, and then try to hold on, because your legs are going to go. They're going to vanish. That's going to happen.
And it kind of feels like we saw it last night, and we're so used to, hey, if the Canucks are up two, especially going into a third period, we've talked so much about their defensive structure, it's like generally they're going to hold on. And even if they are getting a little swarmed defensively, Thatcher Demko is there. Kevin Lankinen is there this year, and it's been fine. So it does feel like the key to the Canucks, if they were to get a win tonight, is, to your point, getting a goal early, trying to get ahead early so that you can at least play with a lead, because it just doesn't feel like lately the Canucks have had enough to come back from a deficit, especially against a team like Vegas tonight that is just, they're a really good team. And it, like, especially when you look at that first line, what it can do defensively, Jack Eichel, Mark Stone, they are just excellent in both ends. 650-650, Dunbar Lumber text line. Brandon in Vancouver, Jack Eichel is the best forward in this game tonight, and I feel bothered by that because it makes me think we can't compete with the best. I mean, we've seen the Canucks compete with...
Yeah, they just played two of their best games of the year against recent Stanley Cup champions like Colorado and Florida. I mean, the thing I'm not concerned about this Canucks team with this Canucks team is their ability to elevate their game against great teams. What I'm nervous about is what does that do those one-off performances really capture who they are as a team? Does it really tell us about the true talent level of this group given their inability to sustain that type of form? Like, for it's the baseline that worries me about the Canucks. It's not whether or not their high highs are high enough. I think they've got those ceiling performances in their game. It's just that the floor also seems to fall out on occasion. And, you know, they often still grind out a point in those games sometimes. But, you know, that St. Louis game, that Boston game, and last night, if they play like that, it could get crooked on the scoreboard in Vegas.
I appreciate everyone texting in on the 650-650 Dunbar Lumber text line. Everyone listening, participating as well. Thank you to Lena. Thank you to Arash producing the show. Thank you to Thomas Drantz. I've been Josh Elliott Wolf. We'll be back tomorrow following tonight's game between the Golden Knights and the Canucks. This is Canucks Talk on Sportsnet 650.